Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Hey folks, Mike King from Profiling Evil. My guest on this week's podcast is the Colorado 11th Judicial District Attorney, Linda Stanley. We're going to be talking about policing and prosecutions, and you're not going to want to miss this one. In fact, you're going to hear about her approach to handling these kinds of cases. We might even dabble a little bit in the Suzanne Morphew case. We'll talk about serial killer Alan Lee Phillips. And of course, I want to touch on Kelsey Schelling's murder case and the conviction of Dante Lucas. Linda, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mike.
It's really nice to have you here. I do have one question that I just have to ask because it's one more piece of this puzzle in your amazing career. And frankly, it brought this huge smile to my face when I read it. You even worked as a long haul truck driver.
Yes. And it wasn't really long haul. It was local. I worked for a mail contractor. So I hauled loads of mail from the airport, DIA, to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and back twice a day.
Well, Linda, I was really pleased when you won the primary election in the 11th district, and I watched a lot of the videos. Of course, I've had a pretty big interest in Colorado for a number of reasons in the last year, but I was pleased not only because you come with an academic background and true prosecutor experience, but the fact that you'd served as a police officer in Denver was to me like one of the biggest bonus points in a district attorney that I've seen in a long time. How has that experience as a police officer helped you in your role as a district attorney?
So I wasn't a police officer in Denver. It was in the Denver metro area, but actually the way that I think it serves me best is because I'm able to, when I read a report, and I'm able to tell officers, you need this or that, or you still need to go do this, they can't say to me, well, you don't know what it's like out there, because I do. And I do understand how they feel when they think they have enough, but they really don't have enough to take the case all the way to trial. So we have to work together and help each other. So I can train them and they can say, well, this is what I have. What do you think about this? Is that enough? And just communicate with each other instead of making it adversarial.
Well, and as you think back on that career, and we see some of the things that have happened recently in the news with the Chauvin case, some of the challenges in shoot-no-shoot situations that law enforcement faces, how has that helped you in making decisions on whether police officers are relieved of responsibilities in a particular situation or held to a standard of accountability?
Well, again, as a former police officer, I can tell when I'm looking at something that has to do with whether or not they acted appropriately on whether or not they really did, because I've probably been in a situation like that or very close like that before. And I know the options, and I also know what the defensive tactics should be and the levels that of force that should be used, because I was trained in that.
Yeah, it's such an interesting challenge that police officers face, and it's too bad we can't let every citizen go through the shoot don't shoot scenarios in training situations and feel the pressure and frankly see how difficult that decision is made, and in fact is made in training long before the situation actually unfolds.
Yes, and there was many different trainings that we had where there was like a big movie screen or video screen, and you had a weapon that, you know, would fire but not necessarily fire, and you had to make that decision in a split second on whether or not that bad guy had a weapon or not, even though, you know, all the way up there, you can even feel your adrenaline going when it's not real. And you don't know what, you know, if something's up, but you just don't know what. And then there's a sudden movement and you have to make a decision right away or someone's going to die.
Well, so something compelled you to reach deeper, Linda, and you decided to go to law school. What was it and why did you choose to do it?
So I always had an interest in going to law school, even as a police officer. And so I always wanted to learn more. I loved going to court, and I liked looking up the law and putting that in my reports and doing that little extra kind of thing. So I always wanted to go. After there was a couple of officers who were shot here in Denver and killed, I decided, I was pregnant with my first child at that time, and I decided I don't think I want to do this anymore because I don't want my child to grow up knowing me on videos and photos and stuff. So that's when I decided to go back to driving a truck while I went to school, and I first got my master's degree in public administration. And so, yes, I was driving a semi while I was pregnant, and then eventually I got to law school.
Well, you know, I want to talk a little bit about law school, but before I do that, you know, it's interesting. I've been asked a lot of times by folks what the major experiences were that stood out to me during my law enforcement career. And I think most people expect some kind of an answer like a high speed chase or capturing some dangerous fugitive. But in reality, probably one of my most impactful moments had nothing to do with those high adrenaline moments. What was the most memorable experience you had as a police officer? And then I'd like to know what it is as a prosecutor.
So I have a couple as a police officer. And I know that a lot of people that work in law enforcement, they talk about, you know, whether or not you ever, you know, fired your weapon or pulled your weapon. They talk about any really big arrests you had. And I liked working graveyards, and a lot of people didn't, but I found it easier to kind of find the bad guy and during graves. And so I had one incident where I had stopped an individual. I just got a feeling when they drove by and got the reason, the traffic violation, to pull them over. But I was on the outskirts of town. It was really, really dark. There was no lights or anything. And I knew something was up. And he said he didn't have any ID or anything with him. I asked him if he had a wallet, and he said no. And I said, well, just, you know, give me your name and birthday, and I'll run you through the system, get you on your way, blah, blah, blah. But I knew something was up, so I kind of trying to act like I didn't know anything was up. And, you know, I was just stupid and new and whatever, you know, popping my gum and got my pink lip gloss on, and he doesn't know any better. So he gives me his name and date of birth, and I go back, and he said that he did have a driver's license in Colorado, but it came back with no record found. So then I was like, ding, 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 he's lying. So I went back up to him and I said, well, you're in luck. The computer systems are down. So, you know, I can't verify whether or not, you know, you have a driver's license. So I'm going to go ahead and let you go. But before I do, you know, do you have anything I need to know about? You have any weapons, blah, blah, blah. No, do you want to, you can certainly, yeah, we'll step on out of the car. And I had my cuffs out already behind my, you know, my thigh, and cuffed him up right away. And he was like, what the hell, what the hell? And that's when I said, do you lie to me? And you have a wallet in your back pocket. And I pulled it out. And his identification was from Ohio Department of Corrections. He was actually escaped. He had an NCIC warrant out for escape and two counts of physically resisting an officer. So, yeah. And after I had him cuffed in the car, my backup arrived. But anyway, I saw him look at my gun when he got out of the vehicle. And I thought, if I would have been a guy, he probably would have hit me. But because I was a girl, and because he thought, I don't know anything, I got away. You know, he thinks he was going to get away with it, but actually I got away with it. So Ohio came out to extradite him back, and they stopped by the PD, said, can we meet the officers that got this guy? Because he's really bad. Our COs are still in the hospital, blah, blah, blah. So I just come out, hi. You know?
That's fantastic. So, Well, you know, and that isn't yeah. isn't that so telling if we could, as we think about these challenges with less lethal approaches, if we would use our mind a little more. And of course, you know, when I worked my way up through the ranks, I always thought if I could keep my patrol officers out of trouble for 4 or 5 years, they'd turn into really good police officers. But, the female officers were much better, maybe because it was of size or whatever else, of actually using their brains in those encounters.
So when we had bar fights and stuff like that, they would wait until I got there, because I have a very loud voice that could bend steel, and it, you know, and it's kind of a mom voice too. So if I go in there and say, "You shut up and get over there, and I don't want to hear a word out of you," got it? "Yes, ma'am." You know, there. But if guys went in there, male officers went, there was going to be a fight. But in the reverse, I can't go in on a girl fight, though, because then I'm going to be in it, too. So it's one of those things.
Yeah. Did you find that you understood men better or women better based on the way you grew up?
I think I understood men better. I was probably a lot more of a tomboy. And, you know, I like guns. And I would go pheasant hunting with my dad, fishing with my dad. I still like to shoot pool and shoot guns and play poker and drink beer. So I guess it's more guy things.
You know, before I leave this topic, I wondered what your thoughts are on yesterday in Alabama, a police officer pulled over an individual for a plate violation, registration or something. And as he was talking to him, he noticed there was a weapon in the vehicle. And when he said something about the weapon, the driver pulled the vehicle out and pulled away. Didn't hit any high speeds, but he obviously was pursuing him. He called for backup, right thing to do, said the guy has a weapon. They pulled over this individual who got out of the vehicle with the gun in his hand and was waving it around, and the officer decided to deploy a taser. And the mindset, I'm only putting my opinion into this at this point, Linda, but thinking that with all of the stress right now, less lethal, he should have taken a gun to a gunfight, but he pulled out his taser and tased the guy who ended up shooting the officer. Both officers returned fire, and sadly, the offender was killed. But what are your thoughts on the way this pendulum has swung on lethal, less lethal approaches, and what kind of training is it going to take to be able to make that jump more quickly so we don't have officers getting hurt because they're afraid to do what they have been trained to do in some cases?
Well, I really wish that the people who were trying to legislate things like this would go to these shoot, no shoot type scenarios and take a look at what it's really like. I asked a lot of people during school and stuff when they would kind of try to discredit the police, how many ride-alongs they've been on. And that if you want to say that they're not doing their job, at least try to learn a little bit about their job first, because they're not coming to you saying you don't know how to do your job, but you're telling them that you know how to do their job. You know how to do their job better, and you really don't unless you at least got a taste of it. So I encourage people to try to do some ride-alongs, and I think that people that are legislating should try to do those. And I have actually asked some too, and they just absolutely refused. They said it didn't matter, and it does matter.
I agree. It does matter a lot. I wish there was a way to get more involvement from the public in these things. Certainly understand the emotion people feel and the concerns they have. But you and I can attest to the fact of how quickly a scenario can change and become violent. And a police officer who's afraid to react or is fearful that even his own administration is not going to back that officer is really in a tough position.
Well, I agree. And then, you know, how long did it take them to get to the point where they became a police officer? How long did they have that dream to have a split second decision make them possibly lose their career, lose their home, lose everything? What are they going to do now? You know?
Yeah. Do you worry at all about what I think we're seeing is a decline? I mean, 4 years ago, the major city chiefs of police talked about in a meeting I sat in that most departments had about 10% of a staffing deficit of what their sworn capacity was. I would bet, given the current environment and the number of people we're seeing retire now, that those numbers have got to be increasing, and it's going to be more difficult to get people to sign up for this job.
It's going to be very difficult, and you're not going to be able to do it unless you can provide a salary that's, you know, high enough to put up with what they have to do. And just the general disrespect and possible, you know, complaints that come in that they have to defend themselves on. When I was an officer, body cams weren't out yet, but we had dash cams, and I also had a little tape recorder that I kept in my vest. And I did that because if people, we had a great chief, and if people filed a complaint, on the complaint form, it said, you know, there's likely a recording of this incident, and if it comes to light that you are not telling the truth of what occurred, we will charge you with false reporting. So a lot of people would say, oops, okay, I'm not going to fill this out. Thanks anyway, you know, but it saved you a lot. There was a lot of officers that, so not all of our cars had cameras in them, and officers would try to get those cars. They didn't want cameras. I always wanted the camera. I always wanted it to be on tape of what exactly I did.
I believe that body cams are actually more helpful for law enforcement than they ever thought they would be in the beginning days.
Well, they are, but there's instances where they need to have them off, and people seem to think that because they turn them off, that there's something evil happening, you know, and they're conspiring against what, and that's not necessarily true. And I remember when the 217 legislation was here in Colorado, and a friend of mine had said, I don't understand why they can't keep it on all the time. And I said to her, I said, well, how would you like it if somebody was reviewing what you did at your job all the time that's never done your job? And then she's like, oh, okay, I get it. So, yeah.
Well, folks, you're listening to Profiling Evil podcasts, and today I'm speaking with the new district attorney in the 11th Judicial District in Colorado, Linda Stanley. We're talking about her focus on crime and cold cases and just all kinds of things. Linda, I was wondering what one of the most memorable court experiences are that you've had.
You know, my first couple of trials in county court, and the judge there had said, you know, you have a way with people. The jury just seems to like you right away, and you kind of reel them in even during voir dire, let alone opening statements. And so the defense has quite an uphill climb to overcome the fact that I'm just kind of personable and funny or whatever, that they just kind of gravitate to me right at first. And I agree that they do have an uphill climb then. If I can reel them in and get them to trust me and like me, then they have a huge, you know, barrier in front of them that they have to get over in order to have the jury vote for a not guilty.
Yeah, I mean, how powerful is that to be able to, as a prosecutor or defense attorney, to have the jury trust what you say?
It's big.
Well, so let's talk about your goals for the 11th District. You've been in office now 4 months. What are your long-term goals, and what do you think you're hitting the marks on right now?
So one of my biggest goals that I'm actually, one of the reasons why I'm here is that I know that the citizens of this district have not had a district attorney that they necessarily trusted. And this has been, you know, possibly even for a decade or more. So I'm going to be transparent and available for people. And I have been. My cell phone number was out during the campaign, and it's still my cell phone number, and people have still contacted me. They've sent me something on Messenger and told me, well, somebody said that you would answer me, and I can't believe that you did. And well, of course I did. I mean, why wouldn't I? That's what I don't understand, is these people have been calling and asking for, you know, answers, and they haven't even got a return phone call. And that just, I can't understand that at all. So I have a lot of catching up to do on that, and I'm going to do it. And I've let people know I am looking into it. It's going to take some time, but I want to let you know that I am looking into it. So that's one of the biggest things, is to be more transparent and say, yes, I'm here. And I'm not going to be able to give you the answer you want all the time, but at least we'll call you back and give you an answer.
Well, you know, I think of that, and I really appreciate that, because I think of one of the areas I think this profession that I love so much has failed to some degree, and that is giving feedback to family members, victims of crime, on cases that have gone quiet because the months or years pass by. Isn't there more we can do to just let them know, no new news, but we haven't forgotten you?
So, yes, and there's other cases out there that maybe people haven't reached out to me yet. I just don't know. But I think it was important not only to return their phone calls, but I've been in touch with the law enforcement agencies, almost all of them now throughout the district, to ask them about some of the cases that they have that perhaps they would like our office, when I established the cold case unit, have our office look into, and they've been very responsive to that as well. They agree about what I had said previously about having fresh eyes on a case and kind of staffing it, is what we called it, when we're all there bouncing ideas off of each other. And it really has great results so far in being able to, that's why other places have cold case units, for that same reason, is that you're trying to get other ideas and other perspectives onto a case and not just have it sitting in a box somewhere because one person said, well, there's nothing else we can do from here.
Well, that was one of the things that I think I was most impressed with. I watched a fireside chat that you did on a particular channel once, and it was your passion for cold case investigations. And frankly, Linda, if I were 20 years younger and wanted to live in Colorado, I'd be asking you for a job, because I am so passionate about cold cases. It isn't just one more case to give to an investigator that already has a heavy caseload. It's got to be somebody who's dedicated to really understanding what you do to turn a cold case around. What are some of your thoughts on just your emphasis about cold case investigations and this idea of putting together a unit?
Some citizens think that some cases were not investigated appropriately, and perhaps were not investigated appropriately because there was a crooked cop involved. So I'm not saying whether there is or isn't a crooked cop involved. What I'm saying is that if our cold case unit investigates that and finds that there was a crooked cop involved in it, then we're going to prosecute that crooked cop. If we are looking into it and find that they have done everything correctly, then I'm hoping to give the citizens some peace of mind that, no, this wasn't a case of a crooked cop involved in an investigation. It's just reached a point where we can't go any further. So they know that somebody else took a look at it, instead of thinking that just one person who they think may be crooked took a look at it for whatever reason. There's been a lot of mistrust for some elected officials in this district, and I understand that. So I'm hoping that I can turn that around a little bit. It'll take some time, though.
Yeah. What's your thoughts on leveraging this true crime community that's out there that I'm now a part of? Is there a place where they can play a role without getting in the way?
I don't know. I'm open to suggestions, though.
Yeah, that's something I'd like to explore further with you, because I have some really strong feelings about the fact that law enforcement has to evolve and figure this out. It's not, social media isn't about having a Twitter account or a Facebook page, but what can you pitch to the public? We saw with Suzanne Morphew a few months ago, the sheriff actually pitched out, again, a reminder to the public, if you know anything, step up and tell us. Maybe it becomes more prescriptive than that down the road, that we say, here's a particular area we need help in, and maybe take advantage of these things like the dark web and people that are really good at figuring that stuff out and having a mechanism to report that back in a way that doesn't impact negatively what you may be needing when you go to trial.
Well, I think it's important that when you have a case like you just spoke about that's been investigated for almost a year, to continue to put reminders out to people, because you and I both know if somebody knows something, they're usually going to say it to somebody else at some point. They're going to say, well, I saw blank, or I think blank because he said blank or she said blank. And they'll keep it quiet for a while, but they can't help just opening up to somebody else and saying it to somebody else. So it's important to continue to put a reminder out there just in case something was said at some point to somebody else and they didn't know if they should reach out or is it important enough or who do I reach out to every now and then just kind of put that out to give, remind people, hey, if something came up or if you are ready to say something now or you've talked to other people about it and now you want to or whatever, just to put it out there to give them that option to say, we're still here. We're still interested in talking to you if you think you might know something.
I've shared with you in the past how much courage I think it takes for a prosecutor to put on a circumstantial case. And I wanted to ask you about one in particular, the Kelsey Schelling case where Dante Lucas, entirely circumstantial case. We've never found her body. And yet a prosecutor was willing to step forward. You were a prosecutor in that community at one time. What are your thoughts on circumstantial cases and can we do more of them?
So the circumstantial cases, the reason that they're difficult or no body homicide is because the defense will inevitably say something along the lines of, they just took off on their own. They didn't want to be around here anymore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you have to try to prove a negative, basically, and prove that didn't happen, which is very difficult to do. And obviously, they only have to put that reasonable doubt into one juror's mind in order to have, you know, a possible mistrial or a not guilty verdict. So the not guilty doesn't mean innocent, by the way, which I used to say all the time, which people say he was found innocent. No, nobody's ever found innocent. Not guilty simply means I didn't prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a big difference between innocent and not guilty. Anyway, so I think.
Yeah, I really like that. And I often think back, even in my days investigating, I almost would prefer to have circumstantial and physical evidence over an eyewitness account or something else that could be so influenced by biases and backgrounds and other kinds of things.
Right. When you do have somebody on the stand that is an eyewitness, they're going to get, you know, cross-examined, obviously, about their credibility and what they really saw or didn't see. And I mean, you know, you remember the movie My Cousin Vinny, right? So stuff like that.
Great training video for a prosecutor. Well, that's interesting. Well, folks, I'm talking with Linda Stanley, the district attorney for the 11th Judicial District in Colorado. We're talking about the direction she's taking her office and the impact that she's having. We've been talking about some of the cases that are being filed and have gone through. I wanted to end on a question with the Kelsey Schelling, Dante Lucas homicide trial. What does it feel like as a prosecutor when the carpet's pulled out from underneath you, like a star witness being murdered days before testimony?
Well, you can never fully prepare for a trial, as you know. I figured out years ago when I first started going to trial and I'd be up all night making bullet points and what ifs and what ifs. And then I figured out I'm a lot better at just doing it on my feet than I am, you know, thinking on my feet than I am trying to figure it out. So I just kind of go with the flow. So if something like that happens, then you have to decide whether or not you can continue or you have to dismiss or how important it was or not. And you just have to just make a decision. Each case is, you know, fact specific. So you would have to look at that before you make a decision.
Well, I wanted to talk about a case that happened just a few months ago. Alan Lee Phillips was arrested in early March for the murders of Annette Schnee and Bobby Oberholzer, if I got her last name
Bobby
right.
Joe Oberholzer.
Yeah. These young women were working in and around Breckenridge at the ski resort 40 years ago, 1982. And the case finally came together with, I'm sure, the culmination of a whole bunch of evidence, a ton of dogged determination on investigators. And as a brand new DA, you're now in a position that you can take a case to trial. And thankfully, we have things like DNA and the advances that we've seen. But can you talk at all about that case, knowing that it's going to be going to trial, but maybe from a satellite view?
I can talk about what we did and how I got involved up to the arrest to a certain point, but anything about the investigation, I can't.
So, yeah, just, I mean, give us a high-level feel for that and what it was that motivated you to take on a challenge like that.
Well, I didn't need motivation. It's my job. So, and I know that they were, the sheriff's office was waiting for the results of the election before they decided to go to the DA about it. And then when it was me, they waited until I was sworn in and then asked if I would come up there right away. And I did. And as I stated in the press conference, I was working on it day and night for 6 weeks with them. I was the only person, my office knew that I was not there. They knew I was in Park County. They knew I was available by phone or whatever, but they didn't know anything else. It was important to make sure that nothing else got out. When we got to the point that we were going to see if we could arrest him, I was also there. And I remember one of the sheriff's offices that was assisting it said, wow, I wish our DA would, you know, be here and stuff like this, because they had a lot of questions and somebody was actually there, you know, to answer it. The night before, I was a little bit anxious and I couldn't figure out why. But I was in a motel and there was like maybe three television stations available. And so the only one I could get was in the middle of a Family Feud episode. So I'm just turning it on to try to get my mind off of something else. And then I saw the family that won Family Feud. And I actually took a picture of it. And I have the picture on my phone. Their last name was Oberholzer. And right then I knew. I knew everything was going to be okay. And when I went in the next morning, I showed the sergeant. I said, we're going to get him today. And she said, how do you know? And I said, this is how I know. And I was very confident and very assured and calm. And we did. And it was true. And that's not a very common name. So that was not that was not coincidence. No such thing as coincidence.
No, we need to let Steve Harvey know about this so that family can know. Because I'm kind of like you. I know you're a person of deep faith. There are no coincidences, are there?
No, there's not. And that's why. And when you know that, then that's how I was so full of anxiety and I couldn't figure out what to do to get rid of it. And then it was like, boom. There it is. Oh, okay. Thanks. That helped. Here, I think I have it on my phone. I'll see if I can find it for you because it.
Be awesome. We'd love to put it up because while we'll do this as a audio podcast next Wednesday, we'll do a video portion of it and it would be fun to put that up. Let's see.
Can you see it?
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yep. And the date of that was February 23rd at 2110 hours is when I took that. And we arrested him the next day.
That is amazing. Well, Linda, as I've kind of cyber snooped your background and over the last couple of months as we visited on the phone.
I know you're right there on the border of stalking, Mike. I got to tell you that.
It's a gift and a curse. You can't ever take the investigator out of the cop, right?
No.
But one thing that I really liked was, are you comfortable sharing your tattoo on your left wrist?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, there it is.
Linda, what is the quote and why is it significant?
So when I first started, when I moved to Colorado and I started at school again to get my bachelor's in criminal justice, I came here with my associate's in criminal justice. I had a bumper sticker on my Jeep that said, if you want peace, work for justice. And to me, that statement was incredibly powerful because it wasn't as simplistic, to me anyway, as it might sound. Because peace and justice come in many different forms to many different people. Peace does not necessarily mean peace like war and peace. Peace means I know that everything was done, or I know that people worked really hard on this and this is the most we can get, or something like that. And justice means justice for everybody. It's not just, you know, the victim or the victim's family. It's also for the defendant and the defendant's family. So there's peace and justice that goes on all sides throughout everything. So I thought it was very powerful. And so in law school, there was a tattoo convention. So, and I never got a tattoo before, but I obviously in law school, there's a lot of Latin. So I decided to get that put on my left wrist in Latin. And I didn't know how to do it in Latin. So I kind of Googled how to do something between Latin and English. And I sent something evidently to a Latin professor somewhere in California who I think thought I was a student, who sent me back the exact verbiage I needed. And I took that with me and had it done. And it says, if you want peace, work for justice for the greater glory of God underneath it.
You know, I think about all of the unsolves and the missing persons and the unidentifieds, and a bunch of those are in your district. And knowing that that is what's driving you brings some solace to those families, I hope. And I know that you will continue to work for justice in those areas. But what's next for the 11th district as you continue forward?
Well, as I stated, we're going to, you know, be more transparent. I'm trying to put together the cold case unit, but we're having some issues with having enough office space to do that. And so we're trying to figure out if we're going to knock down a wall or how we're going to do that. As of April 1st, we're fully staffed, which is a miracle of sorts, because other districts still aren't fully staffed. It's very difficult to find people, and I understand that it is, so I feel really blessed to have the people that I have. I stated in the campaign that I had people lined up with double-digit years of prosecution experience, and everybody except one has double-digit years of prosecution experience, and that's throughout the entire district. So I was very fortunate to be able to kind of use the people that I knew and people that knew me and said, hey, you need to go work for her and stuff like that. So it worked out very, very well. So now I can concentrate on some of the other things that have to do with administrating the office and helping train law enforcement a little more. I really want to do case law updates with them and do ride-alongs with them myself, stuff like that. So I'm looking forward to doing that as well. We're also going to be doing a newspaper Ask the DA type column. And so I can put that out there for people too, that they can get some questions answered.
Good. Well, I'll offer you this. You always have a platform to come on to Profiling Evil and share some of those questions from and answers from the DA. I think people would love to hear that insight and understanding. And because it's my passion, I'll offer you a guy who seems to now not only understand investigating cold cases, having done that most of my career, but I'm starting to understand this wacky world of true crime and social media and embracing and understanding. And for what it's worth, if your team would like to sit down, I would be honored to come in and visit with them about how I believe you could leverage this community and still maintain the credibility that you need to maintain to keep a case solid.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate that offer. I, you know, it has only been, you know, about 4 months or so. And when I look back on everything that's happened so far, I'm so excited about where we're going, and it is incredibly busy, obviously, and a lot of things that have to be done. And from how I walked in and had to get it straightened out a little bit to where we are now, I'm super proud of that. And we have a ways to go to get to where I want to be. And I don't think I'll ever be, you know, satisfied or relaxed or think I can sit back and go, okay, whatever. I'm working all the time, and that's okay with me. That's what I signed up for. And when people call and they just don't think that someone's going to call them back, and someone does, I can't tell you how many times, I can't believe I'm talking to the DA. Well, yes, of course you are. I mean, what? I just don't understand the whole, you're a public servant. You need to return the public's phone call, even if it's something that, you know, they're upset about, call them. So I'm hoping that I can get that word out.
Well, from everyone at Profiling Evil, I want to thank you so much for taking time today to give us a little bit of background on why Linda Stanley became a district attorney, why criminal justice is in your blood, and what your hopes are for the 11th district. As we close, I'd like to give you the stage, and I'm going to paint a picture for you. You just all walked on to an elevator, Linda, and you've got three floors between now and the fifth floor of a slow-moving elevator to tell one of your constituents in the 11th district a message you'd like them to know.
I would probably let them know, I appreciate the trust that you had to put me in office, and I'm not going to let you down.
Fantastic. Folks, Linda Stanley, the 11th district attorney for the state of Colorado. I'm so appreciative that you would take time, Linda, and I wish you the very best. Now, it's a question I have to ask. Will you come back again?
Of course.
Hey, folks, thanks for listening to Profiling Evil podcast. I want to thank District Attorney Linda Stanley for joining me and let you know that on May 3rd, she's going to be joining again. And we're going to interview Arizona Majority Whip Leo Biasucci. You're going to like this interview because we're going to be talking about new legislation that the representative has gotten through. It was signed by the governor just a few weeks ago that increases and requires mandatory life sentences for child sex abusers and human traffickers. And make sure you're visiting our website at profilingevil.com. Go to the story maps. You can read more about Kelsey Schelling's case and everything surrounding that murder conviction. You'll also get other true crime information I think you'll find valuable. So please like us and subscribe to Profiling Evil. And we'll see you soon at the next crime scene. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing. But you gotta click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.